Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food here on Heritage Radio Network with me, Erica Weitz, your host. And I'm back. You're welcome. I'm back. I know I took 3 weeks off, but, you know, girls got to work. I had things to do. I had to go to Chicago. Stuff happens. It's very challenging to come up with new material every week for this show, as you guys know. So, but I'm back, and we're doing something a little bit different today. Remember, like a month or so ago, I had guests on the show, and they were Andrea Tutungen and Kara Tannenbaum, my former colleagues who wrote that book In a Nutshell, and we talked about nuts. So, in keeping with that new approach to Let's Get Real, I've decided to have more guests on lately. It gets lonely down here in the Foodiness Fallout Shelter. You know, it's basically just me and Jack all the time, and while we go way back, and he's happily enjoying the little gummy pizza I brought back for him, which he's eating now.
Thanks, Erica.
You're welcome, because he had to eat ants on the previous show, and they were so disgusting that he's using the gummy pizza as a tonic, an antidote. But anyway, Jack and I, we get kind of lonely down here in the Fallout Shelter, so we decided to invite people to join us to break out of our hermit ways a little, so to speak. But because I am a naturally misanthropic, somewhat curmudgeonly person, and I don't really like people all that much, although I also tend to be sort of lonely, which is a whole other story. Anyway, let's not get into that. We have guests. So today we have very special guests because I thought, well, it's early June and it's getting really hot in New York, and what's better in hot weather in New York than cold beer, except that it's 50 degrees here today because we're having a freakishly weird spell of weather and it feels like winter. But we decided to install a little draft line, some taps down here in the Fallout Shelter, so that we can have our own endlessly flowing cold, crispy IPAs. So we put in the draft line, and now we can basically just sit down here for the rest of eternity drinking beer happily and eating gummy pizza. And real pizza, because upstairs from the Fallout Shelter is Roberta's. Anyway, these guys are on hold from California, so let's introduce them. So my guests today are these two great guys, the Beer Curmudgeons, and they do a podcast called The Beer Curmudgeons. And I was a guest on their show a couple months ago because Kristen Wortman, who you all know and love, who is the resident nutrition expert down here in the Foodiness Shelter, got sick, which is weird because someone like her shouldn't get sick, but she got sick. And so she said, oh, I'm supposed to go on this podcast and I can't do it. Can you do it? And I said, of course. And I actually did it from the bathroom of the school I teach at. So here they are, the Beer Curmudgeons. Now, Sarah, I'm not even going to attempt your last name.
Fair is just fine.
Okay.
I don't really know how to pronounce my last name.
It's like, it's not even, it's worse than like a Basque name. So Sarah and Colin, would you like your last name mentioned, or are you anonymous?
I like McDonald's.
McDonald's, that's easy. Name. Yeah, good American name.
Sure.
Yeah, anyway, so Sarah and Colin are the beer curmudgeons. So welcome to the Foodiness Fallout Shelter, virtually.
Thank you. I'm sure it's quite cozy down there.
It is really nice. Next time you guys are in New York, you'll have to come and check us out. We're in a repurposed shipping container.
I didn't realize you were underneath Roberta's. I knew it was close to Roberta's. That's all.
Well, no, that's metaphorically speaking.
Okay.
Because it's a fallout shelter. You don't put it above ground.
Got it. Yes. Yeah. That's where I thought it was. That makes a lot more sense to me.
Right.
Sorry if I just
it's okay.
Exploded the romance. But.
No, I mean, maybe in California, your fallout shelters would be above ground because of earthquakes.
Sure. That makes sense.
That might be what you're thinking. But here in New York, we go deep underground.
Right.
Where it's safe. Although we've had so much flooding lately, we have to get the bilge pumps going down here in the shelter.
It seems like a really hard existence down there.
It's actually not so bad. It's really kind of nice. We have good...
Colin clearly hasn't eaten at Roberta's.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're right below. So we're okay. But I had to basically virtually create the fallout shelter when I started the show because I felt like I needed actual physical virtual protection from the world of foodiness.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so
the foodiness fallout shelter. I got it now.
The foodiness.
It's early over here.
Sorry.
So now
I know.
Now.
I'm sorry. And, you know, it's California. It's foodiness fallout shelter. Yeah. So it's virtual physical protection. Anyway, so welcome to the show. And thank you for having me on your show, whenever that was, a couple months ago.
Thanks for coming. It was great.
Yeah. And how is your podcast going?
Well, the thing about that is we don't make any money off our podcast.
Oh, really?
Colin is...
we make millions.
...is rapidly growing a burgeoning brewery.
Oh.
And I have my own responsibilities, most of which are, you know, listening to new rap records and commenting on them on social media. So we haven't put out... We have recorded, but have not actually released a new one since your appearance, which I think is our longest gap since starting.
Oh.
But there are big plans in the future, and we've got some interesting stuff we plan on talking about and are kind of searching ways to make it a more regular thing. But it's my favorite thing I do, so mm-hmm. I'm going to work really hard to continue it. But it is an in the free time thing, and especially Colin right now is short on free time.
Yes, well, building a burgeoning brewing empire.
Exactly.
We prefer the term dynasty. But,
dynasty versus well. Empire. What's
you know,
the difference?
I talk about this all the time, but like I think it's like it's super awesome to work in the beer industry where so many people are really actually excited about every facet of what we do, you know, from service to production to everything. And like kind of the podcast is a way to kind of engage with that excitement, you know. And so it's it's our way of interacting with what makes our industry special, if that's not too much of an overstatement.
Mm-hmm. But it's hard to find time to do it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we here on Heritage, we have Beer Sessions Radio, you know, Jimmy Carbone.
No, but I know Sam, who I think has been on Heritage Radio. Sam, who used to be with Brooklyn Brewery,
yes.
Now Civilization of Beer. Yeah.
Sam. No, that's the
Dogfish
guy.
Dogfish. This is
Sam.
I'm spacing on his
last
name.
Whatever.
That's embarrassing.
I know. Well, Jimmy Carbone, who owns Jimmy's Number 7 here in New York, beer guy, has a beer show. And his show actually I used to do this during the day, and he was on before me. And I had to change the time of my show because he had all these beer guys in the studio with him, and they'd all be drinking, and it always smelled really bad. It smelled like big sweaty guys drinking beer.
Well, I thought it was going to go a different way. I thought it was just because you drink all the leftovers.
No,
your show would get a little loose.
No. So I switched to daytime show. Anyway, now that we're almost at the first break, so as you know, my show is about what I call foodiness, which we discussed when I was on your podcast. And if people, you know, if your listeners are tuning in and they don't know what foodiness is the whole world of processed, manufactured junk food that masquerades as healthy food. So it's things like soy, sun chips, and veggie booty, and vitamin water, and, you know, protein-enhanced cookies, and, you know, all that stuff, all the junk food in sheep's clothing. as I call it. And that's what I call foodiness. It's an homage to truthiness. It's the truthiness version of food.
Mm-hmm. And when you were on our podcast, we realized there was very clearly a similar thing happening in the craft beer world with these sort of faux craft beer brands that are popping up all over the place.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Which is why I wanted to have you on, because I've never actually done an episode about beer. I've done multiple episodes about alcohol in general, because one of my like major things that gets me riled up is all the flavored versions of things like cotton candy flavored vodka that are on the market, which drive me insane. But I've never talked about beer because I don't really know beer that well other than what I like. I came to beer late in life.
Mm-hmm. Better than never.
Better than never. That's for sure. I didn't really like beer until I was like 30.
Wow.
I know.
I started liking beer decidedly earlier in my life than that.
Yeah. You know, my dad drank Michelob. Which,
well, then, yeah.
But for the 70s.
Then you were wise to stay away.
But, you know, that was exotic in the 70s, Michelob. And I would take a sip, and I couldn't imagine why people would want to drink that. But I came to beer later because I went to Belgium once in my late 20s to visit a friend and drank beer there. And I had, you know, the religious, like, oh, the clouds parted and the light shined down on me.
Mm-hmm. I hear that there's really weird weather in Belgium, because that's happened to a lot of people that I know.
That's kind of like the weather here today, actually. Kind of weird gray, and then the sun comes out, and you're like, what is that? So I came to beer late. I don't know that much about beer. So what I wanted to talk about with you guys is about this concept of foodiness in beer, because, you know, I think we had talked about this when I was on your show about how I feel like beer in America now is kind of where the wine industry was maybe 2 decades ago, where it's, you know, it's broken free from the Almaden jug wine world of the 70s and 80s and, you know, exploded into this incredibly huge artisanal thing like the wine industry did, that beer is kind of there now, or that Americans are at least experiencing beer now in a way that breaks.
Absolutely. And then that's all fantastic. And it's also worth pointing out that the threshold to enter the industry for beer economically is obviously much lower than wine. So that makes it an even brighter situation.
Right.
But
you don't need
as
land.
With wine, I think what we need, what we're getting at here is, because people at that time had only had, you know, Bartles and James, and because we're coming from a Budweiser culture,
yeah,
you're dealing with a massively novice customer base,
right,
and that makes them rot for exploitation and just kind of the okey-doke and for fooling. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
people have no, you know, like, Collins is fond of saying most people who are drinking good beer just started, and I often say most people have still never had a good beer.
Mm.
So it is... I think that's where the faux craft stuff is just so insidious. And also, frankly, there's a lot of people that fit into the literal definition of craft who are doing bullshit.
Mm.
You know? And
because they need something they can mass market, or because it's cheaper, or because they're corrupt.
I mean, it could be as simple as because they themselves are novices as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you have breweries out there being started by people who've homebrewed a few batches. You know,
yeah,
that there are many, many positives to an irrational explosion. There are also some negatives that we need to watch out for. I mean, I Colin and I call ourselves the beer curmudgeons because, you know, it's not that we're not incredibly excited about the possibilities, but I think that we need to critique from within and be intelligent and not just simply be cheerleaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that almost all beer journalism out there right now is either, there's some very good content if you want to learn how to brew, you want to learn how beer is made, then there's some very good work being done. But in terms of if you're just somebody who wants to be a more informed drinker, you're really just running into these sort of, all this faux expertise that is essentially cheerleading.
Mm-hmm. Just like the food world.
And that cheerleading is not really the most helpful thing. Like I said, you know, like, everybody's already really excited. Like, the cheerleaders,
yeah,
are kind of redundant in that sense. You know, and
like all cheerleaders really are.
Yeah.
The guys are going to play the game.
And so, like, you know, for us, it's kind of more about, like, you know, looking at this long term. It's not like, you know, like, how do we get people excited right now? It's like, how do we keep people excited for the long term? You know, like, I'm hoping that I never have another job ever again. So, like, it's really important to me that, you know, 30 years, people be this excited about beer.
Right.
And, you know, I think a big part of that, you know, that longevity is not taking advantage of people's trust, you know? And that foodiness you're talking about, people kind of being fooled, mm-hmm. is, to me, the biggest threat to people continuing to trust us and care about what we do. So, you know, I think you're kind of dealing with a situation where that is this major peril. Because, like Sarah said, people are really excited. People are really into it. And, you know, that makes them ripe to be taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, people who don't know what they're doing, people who do know what they're doing and what they're doing is shitty, you know, major corporations that are just trying to, you know, take all your money and extract it from the community, like, there's a lot of different ways in which that trust can be abused. And so for us, it's really about kind of like focusing on like how do we respect that trust and how do we kind of like build people's knowledge in such a way that it's harder for their trust to be abused.
Right, right, you know? Right. Sort of, yeah, build it, sort of a 12-step program for getting people to trust again.
You know, it's not just like some paternalistic, like, you know, like we need to be good stewards for right. these sheep. Like, it's, you know, it's about like making sure that the people, you know, when they have beer experiences, that they're having them in like in a good way, you know, and that they're like supporting the things they think they're supporting, because that's really what a big part of it is. It's like, you know,
exactly.
People are like, I love, you know, supporting the little guy who yeah. like owns his own brewery and delivers the beer, and then it turns out that brewery got bought by Budweiser.
Yeah, like, right. Well, that's happening and has been happening in the food industry, you know, forever, where a really good progressive small company becomes very successful, and then who buys them? You know, Kraft or General Foods. I mean, we just saw it with Applegate Farms. You know, mm-hmm. if people don't know, Applegate is this was a producer of, you know, sustainably raised, hormone, antibiotic free, really good quality bacon and hot dogs and deli meat and all kinds of stuff. A company I really trusted, a company that I, you know, liked, and I would buy their products and feel good about it. And they were just bought by Hormel.
Wow. You
know? Yeah.
So and so that I think one of the things we touched on when you were on our podcast that I thought was exciting to me was that people engage with that brand in a grocery store. In a grocery store, you're on your own. You're set loose into these aisles,
yeah.
and, you know, maybe the grocer could do something with, you know, what they choose to discount and what they don't, what they choose to feature as an end cap, but really, you're floating around, and you're being manipulated by the packaging, essentially, right, in
yeah.
terms of what you decide to buy, and maybe you've learned that this brand means this is the kind of thing I want to support, and there's nobody there to guide you away from that. Luckily, in beer, beer, obviously, a ton of beer is consumed in grocery stores and susceptible to those same issues. But often when people are turned on to new things, it is mitigated, the experience is mitigated through someone like me.
Yeah.
So you do have somebody choosing what they put on their list in the beer bar, helping you decide what you want in the beer bar. And that's why I think that's where the role of the critic, the curmudgeon, can actually have some nobility. I think it's don't normally want to think of you know, you want to think of the creative people as the noble people, the people who are risking things, and I'm just the one, you know, lying in judgment. And so that's not that, you know, I don't deserve much credit for that. But so to use a real example, there's a very high quality brewer in Colorado that was bought by a private equity fund. And, you know, ostensibly the product is still quite solid. And they have a product that they just dropped the price way down on.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a colleague of mine come in and be like, man, like, we're selling a couple of kegs of this beer a week, and I'm able to mark it up this much. And you know, he was new to the industry, and I didn't really, you know, but I think that's where it's like, that's where the rubber meets the road. It's like, hey, man, there's a reason that's 40% less
right.
than the local brewery's beer. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so, you know, to the extent that Colin and I can be sort of, you know, thought leaders or whatever, you know,
curators,
TED talk term you want to use for it. I think that's a real decision, because I'm sure that guy has bonuses based on, you know, his cost percentages, you know? And so it really is like, though, that's where it's not just this abstract of like, hey, support these small breweries.
Mm-hmm.
It really is like, yeah, man, every time you buy one of those kegs, you're not buying from somebody else
mm-hmm.
that is a likely a underfunded, financially precarious, startup brewery that's less than 10 years old that, you know, will really feel that, you know? Right. And the private equity firm is counting on that, and that's why they're dropping that price and potentially even selling that beer at a loss, so that they'll starve out some of these other smaller brewers. And so those decisions, you know, that stuff needs to be put out there rather than just simply celebrating, you know, like $5 pints of such and such and everybody mm-hmm. getting excited about it. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? So it's just hopefully pushing our industry to take a little bit more of a critical look and be a little bit more thoughtful rather than just jumping up and down with joy at this explosion. And you know, there are millions of things to celebrate, and we hope to celebrate those. But in the celebration, you can, you know, like while you're celebrating is while the forces of darkness are plotting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the role that I sort of see myself in, you know, doing this. And everybody, I mean, here at Heritage, I sort of feel like that's what we're doing. You know, we're like these Sherpas guiding people through this, like, crazy world where you don't really know what's what. I mean, I always, you know, I say it's like going down the rabbit hole. It's like Alice in Wonderland, you know, and you encounter these, like, bottles and pills and shapes and things that, you know, say, eat me and drink me. And, you know, who do you trust? Who's really telling the truth? You know, if you're buying this Applegate Farms bacon, what are you buying now that it's owned by Hormel?
And I think, like, one of the big challenges, too, particularly on that, you know, like, that undercutting note, is that, like, you know, Americans are kind of coming around to the idea that they need to know the truth of what mm-hmm. they're buying. But, you know, we're so conditioned to look at price that, like, you know, like, people will happily ask, you know, why is this so expensive? But, like, no one ever asks, why is this so cheap?
So cheap, exactly, right. You know? We never
and
question.
That's, like, you know, to kind of fight that kind of cultural programming, you're not just talking about, like, people's beer instincts or people's even, like, you know, like, food and beverage instincts. You're talking about people's, like, kind of baseline consumerist instincts. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, it's a really big challenge, and kind of like getting people to focus on story and knowing the people is kind of a clever workaround. But at some point you do need people to start asking it, like, why is this so cheap?
Mm-hmm. Right. What's actually going into it or not going into it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, we have to take a break. We have 9 minutes. We're going to take a very short break. We will be right back with the Beer Curmudgeons. More.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Welcome back to Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food on Heritage Radio Network with me, Erica Weitz, and my guests, Colin and Sarah, the beer curmudgeons, calling in from the West Coast. From one of you's in Petaluma, one's in Oakland. Is that what's going on?
I'm live at 40th and Opal here at the Hogs Apothecary in Oakland, California.
Nice. Are you open already? 10:20
in
the morning?
No, I'm actually hiding in our the room where we sell our vegetables. And there's vinegar going, and
nice.
Got some bottled beer and some tap wine.
Oh, see, it's like your very own foodiness fallout shelter, too.
I am, yeah, actually. I don't think this is going to withstand much, but
you're protected.
I'd be the last to die if something really bad happened in here.
Yeah, you'd survive for a couple weeks at least. Okay, so we don't have that much time left, but I want to just change the subject a little bit. I want to talk about nutrition, but not in a, like, boring, depressing way. Horrible nutrition, you know, like Kristen. No, just kidding.
No.
Fire. That's why Kristen's part of the team here, because she makes it fun. And she's realistic. I'm wondering, I've asked this of many people and I can't get a straight answer. Why is there no nutrition labeling on alcohol, on beer or wine or anything? Is it the lobbyists?
The short answer is effective lobbying.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought.
But there's a growing movement towards that, and I'm trying to remember which brand it is, but one of the, like, the mega brands just started putting nutritional information on their beer bottles.
Okay.
And there's a big concern that that it's going to become regulated, that we need mm-hmm. to do that through the FDA. You know, there's obviously, you know, more nutritional information is a good thing.
Is,
like, a lot of, you know, nutritional information costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of lab analysis that needs to be done and a lot of QA work that needs to be done. And one of the, you know, the many reasons for kind of the explosion of breweries is that that type of regulatory apparatus does not exist on breweries. You know, and I'm not arguing that that's like the best thing in the world, but it certainly is a contributing factor to why you can start a small undercapitalized brewery, is that, you know, there are a lot of those regulatory things which cost money, which we don't have to do.
Right. And and I mean, beer can vary from batch to batch so much also, can it? I mean, the variables. I'm a big fan of Peekskill Brewery because I have a little summer place near there, and we go there a lot. And we'll go in, and the bartender will say, oh, you know, this week's batch of Eastern Standard is, you know, it's really good. It's way better than last week's. And I'm like, well, why? Why isn't it always the same?
Because they're really making it.
Because they're really making
it. It's not an industrial product.
And it's
awesome, too, that their bartenders are allowed to speak about it that way. That's cool. That's that honesty that we were advocating for.
Yeah, and that's why we like it. You know, and I mean, I have my 100-mile rule for beer, which I try to apply to food, but that's ridiculous because, you know, there'd be no olive oil or tea, and I can't live without that. But for beer, it's so easy now, and, you know, that place is a half a mile from my summer place. So we go there a lot.
That's always one of the things that I do when I'm trying to encourage people to drink good beer, is like, I'm like, there's no opportunity cost. You know, it's not like, you know, if you start drinking only good beer made within 100 miles of you that you have no options, or it's all crazy expensive. Like, you can find reasonably priced beer, you know, made within 100 miles of you that you like.
Everywhere.
In the United States.
Everywhere. It's amazing. Like, literally everywhere.
Yeah, it's only getting better, you know.
Yeah. I mean, talk about hyper-local. It's pretty incredible. So just back to the nutrition labeling. I mean, I knew it was, you know, I figured it was this powerful lobby, but, I mean, it seems so counterintuitive. It's, you know, it's an edible product. It's something people are ingesting. Just that, I mean, talk about the power of lobbying, that they've been able to get away with that for so long. And a product that's potentially, you know, so subject to abuse also. And, you know, with beer, I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward what's in it. You know, you can vary flavors a little bit, add coriander, you know, whatever you guys do. But that, you know, that whole, like, flavored alcohol industry, that makes me get all high blood pressure-y.
Well, so there's a flip side to that, too. The other one is that we're not legally allowed to advertise the health benefits of consuming alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Beer is actually, like, a super nutritious drink, particularly compared to any other alcoholic beverage.
Right.
Like, all the other alcoholic beverages, or in any alcoholic beverage, you know, the majority of your caloric content is just alcohol. Like, you can just take, you know, ABV, and there's a multiplier, and you know very closely what the calories in a beverage are.
Mm-hmm.
But beer, unpasteurized beer, has a lot of essential vitamins in it, which are kind of, like, which are really good for you and are more prevalent in beer than in a lot of other things. Dr. Bamforth, who's the chair of brewing studies at UC Davis, he's been doing a lot of work on this recently, and kind of he's shown that there are these really significant health benefits from drinking beer, but you don't generally see them on a statistical basis because the people who tend to consume the most beer are poor. There's like a really direct correlation between, like, you know, the richer you get, the more you switch to wine.
Oh, really? That's so interesting.
Right.
I guess that makes sense.
Charlie is perhaps the most interesting human being. I would listen to him talk ad nauseum.
But we should have him on the show sometime.
you really, really should.
Well, somebody once said to me, you know, beer is just liquid bread.
Pretty
which
much.
Is really interesting, you know. But what about the probiotic benefits? I mean, if it's pasteurized, do you kill off a lot of that?
Yeah.
So if you're buying, like, if I go to Peekskill and order something, you know, from their draft line, is that pasteurized? Do they only pasteurize if it's bottled?
Very, very few small breweries pasteurize. You know, there are, like, some on the kind of, like, big side of small, like New Glarus and New Belgium pasteurize a lot of things. But, you know, Sierra Nevada doesn't. I don't believe Boston Beer does. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, most of those, like, big national small brands, they're not pasteurizing anything.
Even if it's bottled?
Yeah.
Oh, so all the beer that I drink, like Captain Lawrence and Six Point and all those, they don't?
Yeah, none of those.
So I'm getting the probiotic health benefits from drinking. Oh, good. Well, that makes me feel better.
about. Yeah, no, I think the one thing to add to this from just a health perspective on the caloric side is recognizing that beer has food value.
Yeah.
When you're consuming it, you know? So I think, like, people are like, oh, like, you know, a beer is just so filling. It's like, well, yeah, but you also had, like, you ate as much food as you would had you been drinking water alongside
it. You ate 20 chicken wings with it.
And so I think, like, that's something I had to kind of learn when I got into really beer-centric dining and designing menus for paired menus and things like that. It's like, oh, yeah, these guys are also going to drink, you know, 30, 40, 50 ounces of beer throughout this evening. Like, we can, you know, calibrate the portion size, you know, and think through that. You know, it's beer is so associated with gluttony, as you said, you know, the fat, sweaty beer guys doing the beer show, right? Like, which is something I think we need to conquer from a marketing perspective.
I don't like that
being the image of my industry, but yeah. Also, like, even, you know, I kind of had to learn to be conscious of that. Like, you know, like, yeah, I only had that, like, that appetizer and this other little thing, but I did have those two beers, and I actually, if I think about it, I'm kind of full.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's one of my issues with beer, because, you know, I love a good IPA, and, you know, there are a lot of beers I really like, but I find them really filling. So it's, and I'm really small. And I,
right. Well, I mean, yeah. If also, like, people say that, and it's like, yeah, you got a 20-ounce pint of that. You just drank the equivalent in liquid of four glasses of wine.
Yeah, right. Well, like, I know, so which has occurred
that,
to me.
The filling thing is, I think, true in some senses, but also sort of poorly misunderstood. People are like, yeah, I only had two beers. Like, yeah, dude, you consumed 40 ounces.
40 ounces of liquid. You know, that's a lot.
Yeah,
because when, I go to restaurants and have wine pairings with food, they're only giving you an ounce or two of wine.
Exactly, yeah.
So when you do pairings with beer, what's the pour? How much do you give?
So the pour size fight is real because it gets back to that value thing where that sticker shock thing.
Yeah.
You know? And there's just, you will just have, like, hard-headed people that are just like, if it's not in a pint, like,
yeah,
it's not that girly,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I think those people are dinosaurs and are dying off. And I think that, you know, the most logical thing is, yeah, absolutely calibrate the pour size, and I better see a reduction in price. You know what I mean? Like, and so I've got, you know, a really complex and intense, you know, I drink mostly very low alcohol beers, but I've got this kind of fascinating 10% Imperial Stout on the list here at Hogs right now, but we're pouring it in a warmed snifter. And six ounces of pour, you know, and it's beautiful. Like, everybody here should finish their meal that way.
Yeah.
You know,
like,
and take some time with it. You know, it's 6 ounces and it should still take you 10 minutes.
Right. It's not for guzzling.
So, but, you know, that's like beer being this abundant, you know, drink it in a 26 ounce stein beverage is really well indoctrinated into people's brains, and they don't do the thinking that, like, oh yeah, the yards of beer that I see, you know, in German culture were 4% beers,
right?
You know, and
yeah.
So you're likely the IPAs that you're talking about are 7%, you know, and then, you know, it's so, yeah, the beer dinner sort of food calibration, you know, that hit me very early on. Was just, I would be, you know, producing and attending these events and just be like, man, we're only on the second course, and I, like, I'm done, you know, and people just kind of tune out, and you did all this work for these later pairings, and you know, you want the brewery to show well, and you want people to leave happy. So that's something, like, that is a constant challenge, but I think when you can articulate why, and you're not just doing it to get over on people and make more money off them, but you're actually, you know, that Imperial Stout I talked about is $4, right? We do a lot of 12-ounce pours of double IPAs and things like that, which are, you know, really anything over 8% here is going to go in a 10 or 12 ounce class, and as opposed to a 16 ounce class. And we don't even do the 20 ounce Imperial pint for anything. But, you know, our beers are $4.50, $5.50, $6.50. Some of the really, really expensive, you know, high end IPA stuff gets up to $7.50 for the pint. But
right. So when you're looking at it compared to wine, it's actually a much better value anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say, compared to really any intoxicant, unless you're just over, you know, taking shots or something.
Yeah. Well, one thing I do also rage about is the whole, like, $17 cocktail craze, which makes me insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, charging people that much money for basically three ingredients that you shook in a thing and put over ice. That's a whole other story for me, you know.
Yeah, and there is some extremely high-end beer in New York. Being New York has really got a crush on it. And there are, you know, I mean, it was just so funny to me, you know, I was out there most recently and everybody's like, oh, we got to take you to Tourist, we got to take you to Proletariat, we got to take you to these spots that sort of specialize in these very esoteric, very expensive, very sort of wacky, you know, what I would call stunt beers. And some of those are revelatory and some of those are cool and they do pull off the stunt and they land it. But, like, I am a very everyday beer kind of guy, so it's exciting to hear you talk about Peekskill. I thought Maine Beer Company was great out there. And out here, I think just, you know, we're still in the shadow of Alice Waters, like,
yeah,
big time.
Yeah.
So I think people really do, like, you know, our cool beer bars are more locally focused than yours.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, you guys, all, I mean, you also have that climate that affords that sort of stuff, you know, unlike here. All right. Unfortunately, we've already gone over time, which isn't such a big deal because there's no one coming in after me. But we do need to start wrapping it up. So any last words about foodiness and beer and who we should avoid, who we should embrace, words of wisdom, pearls of foam?
I mean, as far as, like, you know, avoiding the crafty breweries that are, you know, the sheep and wolf's or wolves in sheep's clothing, as you were saying,
yeah,
you know, like I said, you can, you know, you can drink beer made within 100 miles of your house and nothing else and not suffer any quality. So, like, as far as anybody wanting to, like, you know, support the little guys and drink real beer, I think it's like, you know, meet some people.
Yeah.
Any, nice, you know, we tend to be like good times people. We make beer for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, go introduce yourself to a brewery and support them. And, like, honestly, like, not only will you be drinking good beer, but, like, once you actually know the people, you feel good every time you buy it. You're like, oh, yeah, dude, I'm supporting that guy, and he's awesome.
Right. Keeping it so within your community, which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, what I do now whenever I travel is I just do a search for a local microbrewery, and then that's where we go, you know, for dinner or drink or whatever. And it's amazing what I've, you know, found in, like, Albuquerque and where was I? Oh, Atascadero. There was really good little brewery there when
awesome.
I was. Yeah. And do you guys want to do a little plug for yourselves and your businesses? Here, this is your chance to talk about.
Yeah, well, just quickly on the last point, mm-hmm. I think the two things that people can do. One is you try to find a publican or a curator with a palate like yours. When you go in and they start showing you stuff and you like everything they showed you, they probably know what they're doing and they probably understand you have a palate similar to yours. Keep going back and explore a little more. Be like, hey, last time I had this beer and I really liked it. Either what else does that brewery do or what else do you have that's like that? And I think not enough people do that. And it's bizarre. People explore this thing. People are explorers, but they like exploring sort of blindly. And that's where you can get taken advantage of. And, you know, so you need to find people who are good at this job. The other thing is brew a batch of homebrew. It's incredibly easy, and you will learn so much just from doing that. And you can do it in, like, one weekend day, and you can do it in a tiny New York apartment. And it is, it's the best way to learn anything, you know? As far as plugs, I work at a place in Oakland called the Hog's Apothecary. If you're ever in Oakland, come see me. Kristen's going to be here seeing D'Angelo and probably hanging out at this bar this weekend.
Who is?
Kristen, your friend Kristen.
Oh,
who
Kristen.
You ragged on for being too into nutrition.
Oh, Kristen, I thought you said Chris. She is? She's coming back out again? It seems like she's all out there all the time.
Well, I mean, D'Angelo's playing here.
Oh, again. Yeah.
It's a big draw.
I guess so.
If you're in the Bay, you know, I appreciate everyone in the world buying my beer from the Hen House Brewing Company and keeping us in business because I like doing this and I'm having a really good time.
Yeah, well, that's the reason
and
to do it.
It's really, really good.
I can imagine. Well,
I'm not just saying that because he can hear me.
I
buy a lot of it and sell it here.
Some friends of mine bought a house in Petaluma, so we'll actually be coming out in the fall to visit them. So I'll let you know so we can
taste and
try. And well, thanks so much for calling in and taking time out from your busy mornings out there on the West Coast. And it was very revealing and informative. And thanks so much for joining us in the fallout shelter.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll talk to you guys again.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. So that's it for Let's Get Real this week. A total departure for us. 40 minutes of talking to guests. Who knew? We will see you next week with an all-new, normal version of Let's Get Real.
Heritage. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging.
It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.